From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
The Pentagon has decided that they will use only psychologists to participate on their BISCA teams, the teams, the mental health professional teams that facilitate interrogations at Guantanamo Bay. They chose psychologists because the American Psychiatric Association decided that it was unethical for psychiatrists to participate on those teams.
Should doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists participate in military interrogations? Today, a debate. We speak with a member of the American Psychological Association calling on the group to take a stand against the practice. We'll also speak with the APA president, Gerald Kucher, as well as a psychiatrist who's a retired brigadier general in the Army Medical Corps. But first, a federal judge in Brooklyn has ruled the government can legally detain non-citizens on the sole basis of their religion, race, or national origin, and then detain them indefinitely. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A suicide bomber struck a Shiite mosque in Baghdad earlier today, killing at least 10 people. The attack comes as the Iraqi capital is under one of the biggest security crackdowns since the start of the invasion. Meanwhile, the Pentagon announced Thursday the U.S. death toll in Iraq has now passed 2,500. The milestone was reached on the same day the Iraq war was the subject of intense debate in both houses of Congress. In the Senate, lawmakers voted 93-6 against a measure to withdraw U.S. troops by the end of the year. The measure was introduced by Republicans who claimed to be acting on a proposal by Senator John Kerry. Five Democrats, Russ Feingold of Wisconsin, Barbara Boxer of California, Robert Byrd of West Virginia, Tom Harkin of Iowa, and Edward Kennedy of Massachusetts, joined Kerry in voting for withdrawal. The House is expected to vote on its own Iraq resolution today. On Thursday, Republican Speaker Dennis Hastert urged lawmakers to support the measure.
They know their sacrifices on foreign shores are keeping the battle against terrorists out of our cities. They know that by going into harm's way, they are keeping Americans safe. And they know that they are helping a proud and but brutalized people to throw off tyranny and stand tall once again. They know that they are liberators, not occupiers. Our men and women in uniform know all this, and they are proud of it. It's time for this House of Representatives to tell the world that we know it too. That we know our cause is right, and that we are proud of it. Stand up for freedom. Adopt this resolution.
Democrats have accused Republicans of constraining debate by focusing the measure on the so-called war on terror rather than the Iraq war. House rules also prevent Democrats from proposing amendments or alternative resolutions. House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi voiced the Democrats' concerns.
The entire country is debating the war in Iraq, except the House of Representatives. So finally, this debate is going to come to the floor. And then a little while within the past week, they said, well, it's going to be about this and that and other things as well, because they know that the case against this war is so incriminating that they really shouldn't really want to bring it to the floor. So they've now expanded what the debate will be about.
House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. Meanwhile, the Iraqi government has announced a leading official has asked the U.S. for a timeline for the withdrawal of foreign troops. The government says Vice President Tariq al-Hashimi made the request during a meeting with President Bush Tuesday. In a statement, President Jalal Talabani said he supports Hashimi's demand. The Bush administration has firmly rejected calls for a timetable for withdrawal. In Somalia, the UN's top official for emergency aid is warning ongoing fighting between Islamic militants and U.S.-backed warlords is augmenting an already dire humanitarian crisis. This is UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Ihan Eglind.
We are seeking humanitarian access to Mogadishu, which we do not have at the moment, which we have not had for a long time. There is a quarter of a million internally displaced in Mogadishu. It's the only capital on Earth where we do not have international humanitarian assistance at the moment.
That was UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Jan Egeland. In Mexico, thousands of striking teachers converged in the center of the city of Oaxaca Thursday. The teachers are in the third week of a strike demanding higher wages and more funding for Mexico's education system. The gathering came just one day after a police raid that teachers say killed two of their members and a third child. In response, the teachers said they would now call for the resignation of State Governor Ulises Ruiz. This is striking teacher Hildo Sanchez.
We don't trust the government now. With all the people's support and the organizations, we're here taking over the Zócalo again. And we'll stay here until Ulises Ruiz responds to our demands and punishes the guilty, the police officers.
Hermenegildo Sanchez, one of the striking teachers in Oaxaca. In the occupied territories, Hamas is renewing calls for a ceasefire with Israel. The overture comes just days after Hamas called off its previous ceasefire following the deadly bombing of a Gaza beach that Palestinians and human rights groups have blamed on Israel. This is Hamas spokesperson Ghazi Hamad.
From the beginning of this government, we repeated this call many times that we are ready to accept ceasefire from both sides, that Israeli side should stop all their operations and aggression in the West Bank and Gaza. But till now, there are no signals or indication from the Israeli side that they are ready to accept this. We hope that this time they can accept it and we can start a new situation, a new beach.
Ghazi Hamad, a spokesperson for Hamas. In Brussels, protesters with Amnesty International gathered outside a meeting of European leaders to demonstrate against what they called European complicity in CIA-backed torture. A recent Council of Europe report concluded 14 European countries have been involved in or complicit in secret CIA operations since the September 11th attacks. This is Amnesty International's Dick Oosting.
We have indicated seven European countries that have been involved in this. Four of them are members of the European Union, and that's Italy, it's Germany, it's United Kingdom, and it's Sweden. Turkey, Macedonia, and Bosnia have also been implicated. So these governments must do a proper investigation. They've refused to do that so far. These governments must take measures so that foreign intelligence agencies like the CIA can no longer operate with impunity on their territory.
Back in the United States, the Supreme Court has ruled the Constitution does not require prosecutors to forfeit evidence obtained through so-called no-knock illegal searches. The 5-4 vote will strengthen police abilities to enter residences without announcing themselves first. The court ruled the social costs of throwing out illegally obtained evidence outweighed the benefits of protecting previous safeguards. In a dissenting opinion, Justice Stephen Breyer wrote, quote, "The majority's substantial social costs argument is an argument against the Fourth Amendment's exclusionary principle itself, and it's an argument that this court, until now, has consistently rejected." The American Civil Liberties Union has launched a lawsuit demanding the Pentagon turn over information it's collected on anti-war groups. In December, NBC News revealed the existence of a secret Pentagon database to track intelligence gathered inside the United States, including information on anti-war protests and rallies. The database included information on counter-military recruiting meetings held at a Quaker meeting house in Florida and anti-nuclear protests staged in Nebraska. The ACLU has already filed against the FBI for spying on peace groups. In New Orleans, officials have announced plans to tear down much of the city's public housing. The units suffered extensive damage during Hurricane Katrina. Rebuilding plans call for much of the public housing to be replaced by mixed-income units. The move will greatly reduce the number of available public housing units in New Orleans. Just 1,000 of more than 5,000 families who lived in public housing have been able to return to their homes since Katrina struck last August. Curtis Muhammad, a housing advocate with the People's Organizing Committee, criticized the plan, saying, quote, "These are the people who were left in New Orleans to die, who were locked up in the Superdome and the Convention Center, and now the government wants to get rid of any housing for them," he said. And today marks the 30th anniversary of the Soweto uprising. On June 16, 1976, hundreds of black South African school children rose up to protest the compulsory teaching of the Afrikaans language. State security forces killed at least 23 people, the first of hundreds to die in the uprising that spread across the country, what became a pivotal event for the anti-apartheid struggle. The anniversary has been marked earlier today with a march through central Soweto, led by President Thabo Mbeki. Thousands of marchers followed the same route taken by demonstrators 30 years ago. They passed a memorial honoring the slain activist Hector Peterson. He was 13 years old when he was killed by South African police, making him the first and youngest student to die in the Soweto uprising. A picture showing a comrade carrying away his dead body went on to become a worldwide symbol of anti-apartheid struggle. Earlier this week, Nelson Mandela reflected on Peterson's death.
Oh, many of you will remember this picture because it was one of the cruelties of the apartheid government. And in this way, it has now been immortalized, and we're very happy for that.
Former President Nelson Mandela of South Africa. He himself was imprisoned for 27 years. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal judge in Brooklyn has ruled the government can legally detain non-citizens on the sole basis of their religion, race, or national origin, and then detain them indefinitely. The ruling came in response to a class action lawsuit filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights on behalf of a group of immigrants who were detained following September 11th. To talk more about the case, we're joined by Rachel Mirapol, an attorney with CCR. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Can you explain exactly what this federal judge in Brooklyn ruled?
Sure. There's some good news and some bad news. I'll start with the bad, unfortunately. The first thing that the judge ruled is that once a non-citizen is picked up for a valid immigration purpose, that non-citizen can be held after they receive a final deportation or removal order, as long as they are going to be deported at some point in the foreseeable future. That means that the United States has complete discretion to detain an individual for whatever purpose it wants after a final deportation order until they cease to have any use for that individual in this country. It also means that because there's so much discretion built into the immigration law, the United States can use criteria that we would normally consider impermissible when dealing with citizens. For example, the United States can decide that it would like to hold non-citizens it picks up who are Muslims, who are Arab and South Asians, rather than other non-citizens for a particularly long period of time. What the judge actually ruled is that because we knew so little about the hijackers immediately after 9/11, that it was actually reasonable for the executive to decide to scrutinize all people who share those who share certain characteristics, that they're Muslims, that they're here in violation of their visa. We think that this is really giving a green light to racial profiling in this country, and we're very disappointed by it. There is a little good news as well. The good news is that the judge has allowed our case to go forward to challenge the conditions of confinement and the abuse that my client suffered at the Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. Now, he's allowed the case to continue against not just the correctional officials and wardens who were at the facility, but also the high-level government officials who we believe were the architects of sweeping up my clients and hundreds of other Arab and South Asian men and holding them in just extremely restrictive and punishing conditions.
Rachel Mirapol is also author of America's Disappeared, Secret Imprisonment, Detainees, and the War on Terror. What about that idea of disappeared? When people are rounded up, one person or many, and no one knows, do they have a right to let the outside world know?
Well, that's one of the claims that survived in the case, actually. Immediately after the men were swept up, there was a communications blackout that we believe was ordered at the highest level of government. Basically, no one was to have access to these individuals. They couldn't call outside the facility, they couldn't write, they couldn't receive phone calls, letters, visitors, not from their family members, not from their lawyers. Lawyers and family members were actually calling the facility where they believed the men to be held. And the people at the facility would say, I'm sorry, that person's not here. This went on for a month, 6 weeks, and our challenge to that policy is alive still, and we'll fight that one out.
Rachel Mirapol, what about the issue of representing people who the government considers suspect, the issue that CCR is bringing to court around spying on the lawyers when they're talking to their clients?
Well, it's a tricky business these days. Whenever you're representing clients who have been suspected of ties to terrorism in the context of this administration, you face the possibility of becoming a target yourself. CCR has filed suit against Bush for the NSA warrantless wiretap program. And in Turkman v. Ashcroft, actually, which is the case that the opinion just came down in, we have actually just received a victory from the magistrate judge who ordered that the United States had to disclose whether the litigation team that's opposing us in the case, that's defending the United States, has had access to any of the contents of our communications with our clients.
You mean whether they've been monitoring your email, whether they've been monitoring your phone calls?
Exactly, exactly.
Can there be sneak and peeks? Meaning, can someone come into CCR's offices and you don't even know that they just read everything on your desk?
Well, we certainly hope not, but at this point, you know, we can't be sure that any of our communications are secure. The judge ordered the litigation team to disclose whether it had any of this information, and also to disclose whether any witnesses who may testify in the case have access to this information as well. The United States is going to object to that ruling before the district court judge, so I think we'll be able to tell you more about the issue this summer.
I want to thank you very much for being with us. Rachel Mirapol, attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights and editor of the book, America's Disappeared, Secret Imprisonment, Detainees, and the War on Terror. We come back from our early break. We're going to have a debate for the rest of the program around the issue of whether psychologists and psychiatrists and doctors should participate in military interrogations. We'll be joined by the president of the APA. This is a debate that is being fiercely taking place within the American Psychological Association. We'll also be speaking with a psychiatrist who was with the Army Medical Corps, Brigadier General. And we'll speak with one of those within the American Psychological Association who says that the military shouldn't be turning to psychologists, since psychiatrists and the American Psychiatric Association have said their members won't participate in these interrogations. Stay with us. Music by Noy here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting on over 420 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on low-power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, and on both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. All of our transcripts of every program are there as well. Should doctors, psychiatrists, and psychologists participate in military interrogations? That question has become a hot-button topic within the medical community in the United States. After 9/11, the Pentagon began using so-called behavioral science consultants, or BISCIT teams, to help interrogators obtain information from prisoners at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere. These teams reportedly advised the military on how to break detainees to make them more cooperative. The techniques they devised included sleep deprivation, playing on prisoners' fears to extract information. Investigative journalist Jane Mayer of The New Yorker magazine was one of the first people to break this story. We interviewed her last year, and she spoke about the interrogation methods used at Guantanamo Bay.
All of the interrogations there are bureaucratized, very, very carefully monitored. There are voluminous notes taken on every detainee, and each interrogation plan is kind of individually devised by the behavioral scientists who are working on it in order to kind of create something that would get at the detainee, particularly the resistance ones, break down their resistance in a very individualized way. So, yes, there was one plan in particular that a detainee's lawyer described to me, in which the detainee was told that a psychiatrist had monitored the amount of toilet paper he was allowed. He was only allowed 7 squares a day, and that was actually an improvement over earlier when the psychiatrist, according to these sources, had taken away all of his toilet paper. I mean, and the New York Times actually had an interesting case recently where they described a detainee who was afraid of the dark, and so he was purposely kept very much in the dark. There's another detainee there I know who's not been able to see sunlight for a number of years. They only take him out at nighttime, and I don't know what the reason is for that. That's David Hicks, but his lawyer has described that. So each detainee has had kind of a psychological assessment and a plan kind of created for interrogating him depending on his weaknesses and vulnerabilities.
Investigative journalist Jane Mayer of The New Yorker magazine speaking on Democracy Now! Last year, just before the annual meeting of the American Psychological Association. Last week, The New York Times reported the Pentagon would try to use only psychologists and not psychiatrists to help in interrogations. Why? Because the American Psychiatric Association recently adopted a new policy discouraging its members from participating in military interrogations, as did the American Medical Association. But their counterpart, the American Psychological Association, has not. The Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, Dr. William Winkenwerder, told the New York Times the new policy favoring the use of psychologists over psychiatrists is a recognition of the differing positions taken by their respective groups. Today, we hold a debate on the issue. We're joined on the telephone by the president of the American Psychological Association, Dr. Gerald Kuchar. He's dean of the School for Health Studies at Simmons College in Boston. In our Firehouse studio here in New York, we're joined by Dr. Stephen Reisner, a psychoanalyst and member of the American Psychological Association. He's a faculty member at the New York University Medical School and at the International Trauma Studies Program at Columbia University. And in Washington, D.C., we're joined by Dr. Stephen Shenakis. He is the former commanding general of the Southeast Regional Army Medical Command. He's a psychiatrist and a member of the American Psychiatric Association. He retired from the Army in 1998 at the rank of brigadier general, is now an advisor to Physicians for Human Rights. And we welcome you all to Democracy Now! I wanted to bring Dr. Gerald Kuchar first into this conversation, president of the American Psychological Association. Can you tell us what the stance of the APA is?
Amazing this week that when the American Medical Association took their stand on this issue, they took a position that's nearly identical to the APA's position on this topic. careful reading of the AMA's statement makes it clear that physicians, just like psychologists, may consult to interrogations that do not cause physical or mental harm to a detainee. Both associations also have explicitly based their position on two dual ethical obligations, the first being to the individual who is being questioned, and the second being to the public. So it's if you put the association's positions side by side, several passages appear to be interchangeable. I should also note that APA has taken a very strong stance against the use of torture, inhumane and degrading treatment, and if anyone is able to identify APA members who have been involved in such activities, we will take disciplinary action.
Dr. Stephen Reisner, you've expressed concern about the APA's position.
Yes. Well, there are a number of steps. Dr. Kuchar made a few statements that I think we could be more specific about. First of all, I have the AMA's policy in front of me, and the AMA it states the AMA policy permits physicians to develop general interrogation strategies that are not coercive, but are humane and respect the rights of individuals. Dr. Kuchar, I just want to get clear. Are you saying that the American Psychological Association's position is exactly the same?
I'm saying that you could put them side by side, and much of them are interchangeable, yes.
What about specifically the word coercive?
Well, that's a very interesting concept. There are a number of, and I can understand why this would be confusing to a psychoanalyst, because psychoanalysis is essentially a human service, health service delivery. You're providing psychotherapy to people. However, there are many other behavioral scientists who engage in types of interrogation that might be deemed coercive. I can give you at least three categories. For example, mental health professionals who do evaluations for the legal system, who assess competency to stand trial, who do criminal responsibility and insanity cases, who do child custody assessments, who give recommendations to attorneys on how to select jurors or to cross-examine witnesses. In addition, we have physicians and psychologists who do independent medical evaluations for people who are claiming disability or seeking life insurance. And we also do employment screenings when we're screening for police officers, for diplomats, for nuclear plant operators, for people in sensitive positions. These individuals may not want to answer questions, and the psychologists in those situations are functioning on behalf of a public interest to apply behavioral science. So there are many, many circumstances that might be deemed to have coercive elements, but that do not involve torture, that do not involve degradation, or do not involve any effort to harm the client.
Well, it seems to me, first, that the use of the word coercive does establish an antagonistic relationship between the psychologist or the healer or the one hired for his mental health expertise and the one who's being interviewed. But let's set aside for the moment the other venues where this might take place and focus on the issue of Guantanamo Bay or Abu Ghraib, where psychologists are being put in a position, or in fact taking a position, that their role is to facilitate gathering information against the will of the detainee, facilitate their knowledge of certain pressures that can be brought to bear on those detainees, using psychology basically as an instrument of the military to further military aims. That puts a higher ethical value on the military aims and a lower ethical value on respecting human life and on healing. You're right. I am a psychoanalyst. I do emphasize the richness of human experience and an understanding of the context of those experiences. And if we take the context of a psychologist on a biscuit team training interrogators to get the most information from detainees in an environment where those detainees' psychology is being threatened as part of the process, the plan. The aim is to deteriorate their psychological state. Then psychologists, as far as I'm concerned, are participating in a grandly unethical program.
Dr. Gerald Kuchar, your response.
Oh, I didn't hear. Was there a question? I heard an editorial statement. I don't know.
He's not asking a question, but just his overall statement, feeling that what's happening at Guantanamo Bay is the overall context is that it is coercive and that to participate that in that is to participate in coercion.
Well, we don't, as a professional association, tell our members that they can't work for a given employer. Obviously, there are some people who don't think that psychologists should assist in the military at all. That's a political preference and a social statement, but there are many very beneficial things that psychologists have done in the military. One example is that the lead officer sent in to help clean up Guantanamo Bay was a psychologist, a U.S. Army colonel, who was sent in to help clean up the abuses as soon as they were reported. There's another APA member, a civilian employee of the Navy, who was sent to Guantanamo and was one of the first people to file complaints with his superiors about things that he observed down there, and he reportedly brought about some changes. I wish I had the assurance that Jane Mayer and that Dr. Reisner apparently have that there are APA members doing bad things at Guantanamo or elsewhere, because any time I have asked these journalists or other people who are making these assertions for names so that APA could investigate its members who might be allegedly involved in them, no names have ever been forthcoming.
Let me bring Dr. Stephen Shanakis into this conversation, who is a psychiatrist who retired from the Army in 98, rank of Brigadier General, former Commanding General of the Southeast Regional Army Medical Command. Your response.
Well, good morning. Thanks for inviting me. I want to lay it out in this way. First, we all, military officers and have this responsibility and have pledged to do the best job possible in the interest of our national security. And what that means is that with regards to interrogation, that we want to have the best procedures possible to get the best intelligence possible. And we want to support our interrogators, military intelligence officers, in their mission in the best way that we can. But I think that we also have to recognize that when it comes to the day-to-day operations, there is a sense of a, quote, fog of war. There's a great deal of tension and confusion. And certainly many of the people on the front lines feel a lot of stress. And what that means is that when we have different specialists and different officers who work in different areas, it becomes much better for them to understand very clearly what are the rules in which they work, and to very often have bright lines between intelligence operators and infantrymen, and in this case, what we're going to be talking about are healthcare providers. So I have supported, and the Physicians for Human Rights have supported, and our endorsements to the standards from the American Psychiatric Association and to the American Medical Association, that there be a bright line between healthcare providers and others who are involved in interrogation or the detention of these individuals. And I feel strongly that healthcare providers, that is, people whose job is to provide the best services possible for the health and well-being of individuals, should not be involved in interrogation. That there is so much contradiction for them, so much tension between what is inherently a coercive process and may be harmful, and what they have pledged themselves to, that is doing no harm and acting in the benefit in the best interest of their patients, that they should not be directly engaged at all.
Now, I'm in full agreement with you, Dr. Shanakis. That's exactly the position that APA has taken. And furthermore, one of the very important roles that some of these behavioral scientist consultants have been able to assist in, at least some that I have talked to, is preventing what you call the fog of war phenomenon. Psychologists tend to call it behavioral drift. When you have someone who's assigned a certain mission, but because of the context, begins to drift away in ways that are inappropriate. One particular thing I'd be interested in your reaction to is the American Psychiatric Association position. It was fascinating to me at their annual meeting that while they discourage participation in military interrogations, Steve Sharfstein, the then APA, little APA, as we refer to them because they're smaller than the psychological group in size, when the statement was released, Steve Sharfstein stated the very same day, while stating the position that they would not discipline a military psychiatrist who does participate in an interrogation. So they're saying, don't do it, but if you do it, we won't discipline you. I wonder if you have any reaction to that.
Dr. Stephen Shenakis.
I don't. I mean, in a way that I could really informed discuss what that may have been, I think, the implications between the Department of Defense and the American Psychiatric Association, or the AMA. I mean, how it's carried out and the guidelines. What I have really felt strongly about is that the language needs to be as specific as possibly can. That when, if there are loopholes or areas where they're wide open interpretation, then in fact they can be misinterpreted, and people may be, in fact, psychiatrists, psychologists, nurses may be coerced by combatant leaders to do what they feel is ethically against their principles. So I think we need, as professionals, to be as clear as possible. The other, I'd like to perhaps make two more points. And one is that within the military career, as a military intelligence officer or an infantryman, may seek to get a doctorate or graduate education in a field like the behavioral science field, because it is part of their professional development. I think that's a very good endeavor for them. And I'd like to see that our interrogators have had the best training possible and are prepared to really understand the mind of the quote-unquote enemy here, or the subject that they're interrogating, because that is much of what national security or warfare is about and requires. But they're acting as interrogators. They wear, in the Army, they wear the insignia of a military intelligence officer, or they wear the insignia of a military police officer. They're not in the Army Medical Department. They're not healthcare providers. Now, the question is for the American Psychological Association, if they're members of the American Psychological Association, yet they're military intelligence officer, what are the guidance to them?
That's an excellent point, and our guidance to them is very clear. Those psychologists who are involved in human service delivery and healthcare delivery and tending to the emotional needs of people who are incarcerated or detained may not exchange information with or in any way participate in interrogation. They're healthcare providers. The people, as I understand it, who provide consultation to interrogators are not in any way involved in health care and do not have access to any of the health or mental health records of the detainees. At least that's what I've been told.
Well, in looking at the guidance from the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health, that is not clear. It's not specific about who are these psychologists, in fact, consulting, and it seems as if they could be people in the medical departments of the Army, Air Force, Navy, who in other situations really are healthcare providers. And I think that's where we really could be causing problems here. Because there is another way of looking at Guantanamo, and particularly in view of these recent suicides, the history of suicide attempts, and the hunger strikes, it is in our best interest, in the interest of our national security, to improve the health and well-being of these detainees. Every time they go on hunger strike or there's a suicide gesture, and certainly these successful suicides, potentially Americans are put in danger because that generates such emotion across the world that our Americans could suffer from reprisals. Now, and I speak to that because there are a fairly prominent group of retired generals and admirals last winter who endorsed the McCain Amendment and sent a letter directly to President Bush in support of the amendment and criticizing any appearance of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment because of the effect on soldiers serving in the ground in the war zone. And we should be acting in medical departments in the interest of our national security in all the ways that we can to improve the health and well-being of these people, because it'll have greater impact across the world as we are in our image across the world.
Dr. Stephen Chinakis, we have to break, and we'll come back to this discussion. Brigadier General retired Dr. Stephen Reisner with us, who is with the American Psychological Association, and the president of the APA, Dr. Gerald Kushner. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about the role of psychologists, psychiatrists, and overall medical doctors in interrogation. Earlier this year, we spoke with University of Wisconsin history professor Alfred McCoy, who's author of the book A Question of Torture, CIA Interrogation from the Cold War to the War on Terror. He spoke about the interrogation methods developed at Guantanamo Bay after Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld appointed General Jeffrey Miller to run the prison camp.
And under General Miller at Guantanamo, they perfected the CIA torture paradigm. They added two key techniques. They went beyond the universal sensory receptors of the original research. They added to it an attack on cultural sensitivity, particularly Arab male sensitivity to issues of gender and sexual identity. And then they went further still. Under General Miller, they created these things called biscuit teams, behavioral science consultation teams. And they actually had qualified military psychologists participating in the ongoing interrogation. And these psychologists would identify individual phobias like fear of dark or attachment to mother. And by the time we're done, by 2003, under General Miller, Guantanamo had perfected the CIA paradigm. And it had a threefold total assault on the human psyche: sensory receptors, self-inflicted pain, cultural sensitivity, and individual fears and phobia.
Professor Al McCoy, author of the new book called A Question of Torture. Dr. Gerald Kushner, you're president of the APA, the American Psychological Association. Your response?
Well, it's interesting. I wonder who these people were that were involved. I wonder if, like Dr. Zanakis talked about, whether they were, in fact, government specialists who had gone back and gotten psychological background. I was fascinated because Dr. Zanakis actually sounded like a psychologist when he was giving his comments. I would agree with virtually all of what he said, and as he may know, the APA supported and lobbied in favor of the McCain Amendment. And some of the advice that he gave is also the type of advice that psychologists would be involved in giving, talking about the consequences of engaging in some behaviors. And just to the point, people who torture other people may get answers from them, but they may get inaccurate intelligence because the person simply wants it to stop and will say anything they have to say, even if they don't know it to be the truth or even if it's made up. So there are lots of ways that psychologists could provide advice that would have nothing to do with emotional pain or degradation.
Dr. Gerald Kucher, are you concerned about the Pentagon's new position, that they'll try to use only psychologists, not psychiatrists, to help interrogators devise strategies to get information at places like Guantanamo Bay because of the overwhelming vote of the American Psychiatric Association discouraging its members from participating in those efforts?
No, I'm really not concerned about it for two reasons. One reason is that we have a very tightly written ethical code of conduct and that we are going to enforce it on our members if we discover that there are members who have been involved in torture or inhumane or degrading treatment. The other reason I'm frankly not surprised is because psychiatric training is so different from the training of a psychologist. Psychiatrists are trained in hospitals and in medical school to deliver healthcare services. Psychologists, some of us, are trained as healthcare providers. Others of us are trained as behavioral science researchers. And some of the behavioral science knowledge of a social, cultural, personality, experimental psychopathology methods might be of use, and this might be provided by people, and this gets back to Dr. Xenakis's point, who are not in the medical corps, who are not providing health services, who have no direct health service connection to anyone who may be asked questions by the military.
Dr. Gerald Kucher, I want to turn back to Dr. Stephen Reisner. There is a growing movement with the American Psychological Association. Some people are saying they're going to withdraw. Others are saying they're going to withhold dues. What are you calling for now with the annual meeting coming up?
Well, there is, I think, a growing embarrassment among psychologists, among members of the American Psychological Association, that the American Psychological Association is unique among the organized healthcare providers in the United States in permitting participation in counseling interrogators at Guantanamo Bay. The idea that one can ethically aid in what is essentially an unethical practice, that's a play on words that I find, and I think many of my colleagues find, an embarrassment and something that reflects very badly on the profession of psychologists as a whole. So what we're doing at the moment, and this is a kind of grassroots movement, it's developed because many people felt the way I did, and I wrote a letter to Dr. Kucher, and then others wrote letters to Dr. Kucher, and then listservs popped up, and now we have a petition online to make an unequivocal statement that you can't behave ethically in an environment that supports something that is unethical, akin to torture. So that the environment of Guantanamo, in its essence, is a manipulation of the psychology of the detainees for military purposes, and that for a psychologist to facilitate that raises huge ethical questions. So what we would like to see is a referendum among the psychologists in the American Psychological Association to get a sense, because I think that Dr. Kucher's position is actually a minority position once we got the facts out there. We would like to see a specific policy statement by the American Psychological Association, which takes into account the ethical problems of participating in a center where detainees are kept, sometimes some of them minors, without charge, without contact, without a future, in a system that deteriorates them psychologically. How can we, as psychologists, say we're going to ethically oversee how to deteriorate people's psychological state? I think that it's a contradiction. It's an oxymoron.
We're having this discussion a few days after three prisoners at Guantanamo committed suicide, the first three to successfully commit suicide. Many have attempted it before. Many have been on hunger strike. It's also about a week after the Danish prime minister was meeting with President Bush and said he wanted Guantanamo closed. Many European countries, the Attorney General of Britain said he wants the closure of Guantanamo, that they see it as inhumane and cruel. You have the well-known Spanish judge, Baltasar Garzón, who was the one who brought the indictment against Augusto Pinochet of Chile, calling for Guantanamo to be closed. Even Condoleezza Rice said, there's nothing more that we want than to close Guantanamo. Dr. Gerald Kuchar, what would it take for you to say there should be a ban on participation in what's happening at Guantanamo?
Well, there's three questions embedded in there. First question, I have to make it clear that neither I nor APA want to be an apologist for the Bush administration's policies. And none of us endorse what is happening on Guantanamo as a phenomenon. I do want to make a sharp rebuttal of the comment alleged by Dr. Reisner that APA is unique. He hasn't carefully read the AMA statement. And he hasn't carefully read the American Psychiatric Statement. The AMA does describe a role for physicians in interrogation. The American Psychiatric Association statement discourages it, but then says they won't prosecute people who participate. And furthermore, when they go on and list the things that psychiatrists shouldn't do, they notoriously leave out any mention of medication. Of course, psychologists can't prescribe medication, and there have been accounts in some of the press that some of these individuals at Guantanamo have been drugged. But to get back to your
Dr. Gerald Kuchar,
question,
just before you answer that fundamental question, the statements have been strong enough from the AMA and the APA that the military has said they'll turn to psychologists, which have a different, the American Psychological Association has a different enough position on this that they know they can use psychologists where they can't use psychiatrists. And in the past, they had turned to psychiatrists.
Yeah, but you notice they don't say they're not going to use the psychiatrists they currently have down there, and they don't say they're not going to use physicians. They just say they're going to make more use of behavioral scientists. And now you would have to ask the Pentagon about their statements. I have no knowledge of what their plan is, and obviously, as a professional association, we don't coordinate any activities with the military.
Your overall response to the point, then?
To which point?
To the earlier point. What would it take to say that psychologists should not participate at Guantanamo, given the international reaction to the idea that whatever an individual does within, that it's an overall coercive environment?
Well, there's two pieces. First of all, we have psychologists at Guantanamo who are delivering mental health services, and I don't want them to stop doing that. We have psychologists at Guantanamo who are intervening to try to be sure that there's no behavioral drift and abuse on the part of the people who are confining these prisoners and who are taking care of them. And dealing with the behavioral drift or the fog of war that Dr. Xenakis spoke of, and I don't want to tell them to stop working. And simply telling a psychologist, you shouldn't participate in any interrogation in Guantanamo, has very little to do with the horrible conditions that some of those people are maintained in, and also doesn't say anything about the detainees that are being held in Afghanistan or Iraq or other places. So if you would like me to say, wow, I'd like to have Guantanamo closed, I'm right there with you. But I'm not going to say, as a representative of my association, that our colleagues who are experts in behavioral science should stop trying to be productive in preventing harm to the public.
Would you would you support or introduce an amendment then in the American Psychological Association, a proposal to close Guantanamo?
Well, we supported the McCain Amendment, and if
that's not about closing Guantanamo.
Well, if someone were to, I'm the president, and as president, I chair the governing board, so I have to not state my personal preferences. However, if such a resolution were introduced in our governance structure, it would be fully debated, and the group would vote on it.
Dr. Stephen Reisner.
But it seems to me that, as you said, Dr. Kuchar, that Guantanamo has been condemned roundly by world bodies, by human rights bodies, that we would all like to see Guantanamo closed. It seems to me that we need to amend the ethics code to explicitly state that in environments where torture or interrogations are being carried out that have been that are in contravention of international law and of human rights, that in those environments, psychologists have no place facilitating those interrogations. It's very, very simple. In concentration camps, in detainee centers, in prisons for for immigrants, it seems to me that we can make a case that there are environments where it is not possible to facilitate an interrogation ethically. And we need to amend the ethics code, and we need to make a statement as a body. And I would suggest that we bring this to the membership.
Are you going to be doing that, Dr. Reiser?
Well, we're doing it in the form of a petition, and that's how we're beginning. And the petition is online as we speak.
Where?
Let me find the...
Let me go to Dr. Stephen Shinakis in Washington, D.C., as you listen to this. What do you see as the main difference between the American Psychological Association's stance and the positions of the organizations you're a part of, the AMA, the American Medical Association, and the American Psychiatric Association? And what are you calling on the American Psychological Association to do?
I would like to see the American Psychological Association affirm the intent of the American Psychiatric, the American Medical Association, and the recommendations of the World Medical Association is that healthcare providers will not in any way participate or be involved in the direct interrogation of any detainees.
I can affirm that for you right now. That's our position.
Now, the issue that we're facing is also healthcare providers' responsibility in consultation to combatant commanders or those people responsible for the detention facilities.
I can confirm that, too. Healthcare provider psychologists are not allowed to participate in detention or even communicate to those who are doing the interrogation. That's very clear in our statement.
If it is that, then it seems to me that within the community of psychologists, as I listen to the discussion between Dr. Reisner and Dr. Kuchar, there is a question of those people who call themselves psychologists and may not be healthcare providers. What is their responsibility, and what are the ethical guidelines to which they must conform? And I think that in this particular case, it would be also helpful for the American Psychological Association to come out and make a statement about the effectiveness, appropriateness, and the ethical acceptability of the kind of interrogation techniques that Professor McCoy discussed. I mean, at the heart of it is, are these good ideas? Do they give us good intelligence? Should any American, in fact, be practicing such interrogation, even if they think it's in the interest of our national security?
Dr. Stephen Reisner.
Yes, I think that would be a perfect use for behavioral scientists such as psychologists to raise the ethical standards to a very high level about how interrogations might be done, about where, how they must not be done, because so far in Guantanamo, the opposite has been the case. Psychologists have been consulted for the what are the buttons, what are the hot buttons, what are the vulnerabilities of the detainees, and they were required. The interrogators were required until last year to consult BISCA team members, which was predominantly members of were predominantly psychologists. But I would like to give you the website for the petition to change the APA's policy, and that is www.thepetitionsite.com/takeaction/483607021.
Well, we will link to that, and also we will link to the American Psychological Association's website. Dr. Gerald Kuchar, do you see a change coming out of this annual meeting on the issue of Guantanamo, on the issue of psychologists participating in interrogations?
Well, if our members raise issues to the governing council, they'll be fully debated, and it's always difficult to predict what will happen. But folks want to see a very specific proposal, some generic proposals that, for just to illustrate the point, a group of people have been saying, APA should investigate what's happening. We have no subpoena powers. We have no ability to go onto a military base. We can only investigate our own members, and we can only do that when people make a specific complaint.
We'll have to leave it there. Dr. Gerald Kucher, president of the American Psychological Association, psychologist Dr. Stephen Reisner, and Dr. Stephen Shanakis, Brigadier General Advisor to the Physicians for Human Rights. That does it for today's broadcast. Democracy Now! Produced by Sharif Abdelkaddous, Mike Burke, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Aaron Maté, Frank Lopez, Mike DeFilippo, and Nick Marsilio, our engineers. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.